In today's show, Switzerland provides its citizens with a new convenient way of dying. Meanwhile, 16-year-olds are fighting for the right to vote here in Canada. And in Alberta, we are still waiting to hear from the Premier on who we can spend Christmas with. This is Penhold Talk Radio. And welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us again this week. My name is Brian Constein. I am here with my co-host, Michael Rowland.
Hello, hello.
We are scanning the globe today, and eventually we will arrive back at home. Like, after all, this is Penhold Talk Radio. So Penhold will get its mention. We'll save that for the end for kind of a little bit of a lighter ending, because we got some heavy topics this week that we're going to kind of breeze through. Though don't take that breeziness to confuse that with the kind of the lightness, that light approach to this. These are serious topics, really, I think, reflecting serious changes in a lot of cultural, foundational cultural truths that are kind of shifting under us, and that we really, I think, need to be paying attention to see where culture might be going. So we'll start abroad. We're going to start in Switzerland. This week it was announced that the government of Switzerland has green-lighted so-called suicide capsules or suicide pods. And these are really, if I'll pop these up on the screen if you're watching the kind of the video formats of the show. These are very kind of space age, cool looking devices. Like these look like virtual reality kind of sets.
Honestly, one of my first thoughts was it really looks like it was inspired by Futurama. I'm pretty sure that there was an episode where somebody dies and they put them in a coffin that looks almost exactly like this and launch them into space.
Okay.
It's got that kind of futuristic look to it.
It does. It looks like a spaceship or some sort of escape pod.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's kind of what's kind of going on here. It is an escape pod to life, essentially. But yeah, no, it looks like something that maybe Zuckerberg would create for his metaverse or something like that. Yeah. Like this is where you would go to engage a new world. But no, this is a device that the developer, Dr. Philip Nitschke, of the appropriately named Exit International. They are a pro-euthanasia group. And these are machines that are advertised as being able to be towed anywhere for the death of someone. And so you can set there, I'm guessing, tow these behind your truck or your vehicle to, as it again puts in, like, very much advertising this as you would advertise a nice vacation retreat. You can take this out to an idyllic outdoor setting, it says. And what this device will do, then you would get into this device and, it has some sort of artificial intelligence that checks your mental capacity. And I've also heard articles talk about, like, this can be controlled by just your eye blinks. So you don't even have to say anything. It registers your answers through you blinking. But what this device does once it's activated, and once it's gone through, I guess it's quote safety protocol, like whatever that good is. Like, if this malfunctions, the thing is that you live. So if this thing works well, you die.
I would assume in their defense that there's some measures to ensure that somebody's not being forced into one. There's got to be some way of preventing it so that you're not being forced into it without consent and being murdered in a suicide pod.
I hope. I don't know but, what that looks like. Like, yeah, how do you tell the difference between someone who's mentally competent and, you know, getting into a suicide pod at the point of gun or something like that? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. But anyways, so what this device does once it's activated is it fills up the pod with nitrogen. So it basically swaps out the oxygen in the air for nitrogen, and as a result, you die of hypoxia, which is the low oxygen levels in your system.
Yeah, they actually say right in the article about it's a disoriented and euphoric feeling. So they're basically trying to say how this, you tow it to an idyllic setting, you get to just have this euphoric feeling, and then it's over. So they're really glamorizing the death.
Yeah, that's perhaps one of the more disturbing things is how this is promoted by this company. This is the kind of the pro euthanasia side. It's always kind of advocated for this suicide. Basically, it's suicide. Euthanasia is just a euphemism for what's going on here. This is suicide. It's always presented as this dignified way of ending things.
Yeah.
Or of ending one's life. Let's put it bluntly. And you know, for some people, you know, life is already difficult enough, and it probably doesn't take a lot to convince people that if there's a convenient way to go out, like, why wouldn't I? Like, when you think about suicide, you usually think about kind of a violence and you know, disturbing kind of way. And I think that's actually the appropriate way we should be thinking about death.
Yeah.
Whether it's killing ourselves or, you know, or murder or something like that. Like, death is not, shouldn't be viewed in kind of a, it's not respectful. It shouldn't be viewed in a pleasant way.
Yeah.
There's something, natural and yet, not quite the way things should be. I think our version of death speaks to higher things ultimately, that things aren't quite set up the way perhaps they were intended. But that might, we'll probably bring that up in another episode, but the way that this is, like, as you say, glamorized is sells death. Whereas, you know, at least within Canada still, you have to go to a doctor. You have to go through, you have to see at least two doctors, I believe. They both have to sign off on your competency.
There's a waiting period. There's a number of restrictions.
There's still some, yeah. Over the years, though, even in the brief time it's been here, it's gone down. Yes. Yeah. There's less and less restrictions. I don't foresee this as not an inevitable thing that this will happen in Canada. I think you'll start seeing these. At least if society keeps progressing in this way, because it's viewed as this good thing. You can die in a dignified way, in a peaceful way, serenely. As it says, you might experience a bit of euphoria at the end. That's just your brain reacting to lack of oxygen, by the way.
Yeah.
But all of this is to sell it. And this is commodifying death. So at least, If there is something to be said for public health care, at least in Canada, at least you can't make money off of dying, or at least private companies. There's always argument that government is making money if the patient doesn't last as long in the ICU or something like that. At least in this way, at least with public health care, you know, death is not usually viewed as kind of a commodity that you could sell. But here, that's exactly what's going on.
Yeah, it's a whole different story when you've got a company that's making or looking to make their business, their profits, from selling people on death. You're selling somebody a method of killing themselves, ending their own life, and making a profit at it.
Yeah, that's part of this disturbing element of that is how much this is promoted in that way to be a money making ability, and you can see that just in how it's described in like all of the articles. Like, this, they've done their work to try to sell this as a good thing, mm-hmm. as a painless thing, convenient, and unfortunately, it's probably going to be sadly picked up by a lot of people. And so not to get too down at the beginning here, you know, this is something that as a culture, we have to fight against is this perspective that death can be the solution to a problem.
Yeah.
And really need to be conscious of where that thinking ends up taking society, takes culture, but just, you know, even our neighbors, just, you know, be on the lookout for people that this might appeal to. Like I said, this makes it convenient. In fact, here's in the article here, 7,600 Canadians received medical assistance to end their lives last year. So assisted suicide has been in Canada since 2016, and it's been the number of people who have used that has increased each year since it's been allowed in Canada. The article from Global News says it's up 17% from 2019. And then 2019 was 26% from there.
Yeah.
And so you make things more and more convenient. When there's already seemingly an abundance of hopelessness in the world, like this just makes it too convenient. And really, I think we need to work to make life as attractive as possible. Just do you don't have to change the world. Just make life attractive in your sphere of influence.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, pay attention to this story and how this is going to kind of, I think you'll see it spread, but again, try to spread at least a culture of life around you that this does not, so this doesn't make it as appealing as these people would want it to. All right, so that's Switzerland. Let's move a little bit closer to home in Canada, particularly Ottawa. Last week, we looked at a story, we looked at the passage of Bill C-4. This was the ban on conversion therapy. And we talked last week about how quickly it passed through the House of Commons. So it was it was tabled or introduced on Monday. The Monday, I guess it'll be about 2 weeks ago now, the previous Monday. That next Wednesday, so 2 days after it was introduced, it passed through the House of Commons. First reading, second reading, it passed unanimously. So there's no one who voted against it. So keep that in mind when you're thinking conservative. So after it passed through all those, got the kind of jumped through all those hurdles in a single bound with no opposition, it lands at the front door of the Senate, which is where kind of the old conversion therapy bill from the previous session ended, was in the Senate before the election was called. And so it was expected. The Senate would actually take up this bill, have some discussion since they didn't get around to doing all that last time. And I think to a surprise of a lot of people, it passed the Senate unanimously again, or it passed through the Senate unanimously, just like it did in the House of Commons. And again, it was a conservative senator who made the motion to pass it through the Senate unanimously. So in the House of Commons, I believe it was from MP from Manitoba, Rob Moore, who made the motion to pass it in the House of Commons unanimously, and it did. And then in the Senate, it was a conservative. Conservative. That's the quotation, or I'm putting quotations on that. Senator Leo Housakis, I guess, made the motion to pass this unanimously. And he was quoted in one of the articles as saying, "I think we have to get to the reflex in this institution that when something is in this or in the universal interest, public interest, that we should not create unnecessary duplication or engage in unnecessary debates." And if you to me, this sounds a lot like, before we look at the bill, this sounds to me a lot like the argument that parents use against their kids. So if everyone's running off the cliff,
right,
are you going to do that too? Basically, this is a reflex. So if this is of universal interest, if everyone wants this, why shouldn't we go ahead and do that? We should just go along with it. Yeah. Use the word reflex like that. The Senate is supposed to be kind of this, at least it's been so more so in the last few or last decade or so, they've moved beyond simply a kind of a rubber stamp kind of element of the whole legislative or the whole parliamentary system. They've actually held things up. They've actually passed back some legislation with some amendments back to the House. So they've taken the stand in some places, but apparently not here. And remember, this was the article, or this was the bill that bans conversion therapy. But we looked at it last week, and it was more, not so much that it banned a medical practice, because here in Canada, you can already refuse medical treatment.
Yeah.
So this this bill actually doesn't add anything new to patients' rights.
Right. Yeah.
So if you're already undergoing some sort of medical treatment, and you decide not to, as long as you're in your right mind and express some sort of, you're competent, then just say no. But so then that leads to the question, okay, well then why put this bill forward? Like why create the redundancy then? If someone doesn't want conversion therapy, they already have the right to say, no, I don't want to do this. Now, I think the answer comes in, as we talked about last week, in the preamble, where it says conversion therapy causes harm to society because, among other things, is based on and propagates myths and stereotypes about sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression, including the myth that heterosexuality, cisgender, gender identity, and gender expression that conforms to the sex assigned at birth are to be preferred over other sexual orientations, gender identities, and gender expressions. It's new, not in the not in what it restricts, but it's new in what it uses to justify its restrictions.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more about the promotion of that idea than the prevention of the conversion therapy, it seems.
Yeah, and so, yeah, what it's doing is it wants to justify this conversion therapy, again, a redundant bill in the sense that you already have the right to reject whatever medical treatment you're going under. But it, in this case, it does so because it wants to undercut this quote myth that there are, that heterosexuality, that male and female are not interchangeable. Like though, that's the myth it wants to get. It wants to kind of do away with. And yet, like, just think 10 years ago, a bill like this would be just inconceivable. Like, just think of where you were, your mental state. If someone comes up to you and said that parliament was going to pass a bill that was based upon the belief that male and female are interchangeable, I think I said it right the first time.
Yeah, I think so.
If there's going to be a bill that was passed because they wanted to do away with the distinction between male and female, like 10 years ago, something like that would have just been unthinkable.
Yeah.
Like that was fringe NDP Green Party stuff.
You wouldn't even find it as the norm among the less popular groups. It would still be fringe within them.
Yeah, exactly.
It was so far out that it would have the odd individual that might believe it.
Yeah. And so here now, though, 10 years later, you have NDP, you have Green, you have Liberal, and you have Conservative all voting for this. Like, it's one thing to say, okay, we're against conversion therapy in the sense of coercive or harmful practices. Sure. But that's already the patient's rights to refuse that.
Yeah.
Where I think conservatives needed to stand up was against the justification that was built into this. And so now we'll have to see the ramifications, because this, I think, just pay attention to this. I think this is, again, another shift in kind of the cultural foundational truths, that there are clear distinctions and unbridgeable distinctions between male and female, that this kind of bill wants to do away with. And I think this is just kind of a rock in the middle of the pond, and we're gonna have to see where the ripples will end up affecting, because there really isn't a lot of barriers, distinctions, restrictions placed around this bill. It doesn't refer to, it doesn't have any kind of limiting principle, like whether it's the psychiatrist, whether it's the pastor, whether it's a parent.
Yeah.
So if you're talking to your kid about some feelings he might be having, regarding, you know, I guess nowadays, you know, about his gender identity. And if you tell him that, no, Johnny, you're my son and you're always going to be my son. And he goes and tells the teacher that or something, you're actually breaking this law, because you've provided a quote treatment, which is not really defined.
Yeah.
You've provided a treatment, and you've done it from a position where you say heterosexuality or cisgender, to use their term,
is the preference.
Is a preference. Yeah. So, but if you just want to explore the ideas of with them, you can, but you can't come to it from a pro heterosexual, pro cisgender position. You have to remain open in however that looks.
Right.
So something like that, that's just, I don't want to put it out there as necessarily like kind of this conspiracy or fear-based one, but I'm just saying that the way that this bill is written, it's so open, and its justifications that it's based on open the door to that avenue.
Yeah.
So again, when we're talking about culture, we got these kind of the superficial beliefs, but we got the foundational truths as well. And the kind of the ramifications of shifts in kind of foundational truths might not appear until later on. And so right. I'm just trying to give a heads up where this, one of these ripples might end up coming ashore.
Yeah.
So why is this bill important to, you know, a parent in Penhold, you know, why isn't it a big deal? Because who knows where these ripples will come? Where will this affect you at home when you're trying to instill your own values into your kids?
Yeah.
So it's, I just want to kind of give that as a kind of an update to that story. And sadly, you know, conservatives again in Canada are at least the elected conservatives just show how far left they are. I don't think I'm the first one to say it, but go ahead.
Whether they're that far left or afraid to present an opinion that doesn't go along with it, I don't think it makes much difference.
No.
It really doesn't. But whether they believe it or not, they're afraid to go with a socially conservative opinion.
Yeah. I lean towards the fact that there are very few. I don't think it's fear. I just don't think there's a lot of social conservatives left in there.
No.
We had Brad Trost was perhaps one of the last really vocal ones. The one that was running, he was running for the conservative.
Right.
I can't remember his name off the top of my head.
No, I forget too.
Ah, sorry. I'll have to look it up. But there's been very few particularly vocal social conservatives. Yeah. As I was going to say, I'm probably not the first one to say, but in Canada, especially at the federal level, no matter who you vote for, you're voting for everyone, or you're voting in the same direction. All the parties are moving in the same direction.
Just varying speeds.
Varying speeds. Yep. They're just further down the road, but they're all traveling down the same road. And I think this is just proof that's just advancing more and more through the conservative, elected politicians. All right. I think this one should be a little bit more fun. So in Canada, the voting age right now is 18. So it seems like every now and then the question of voting age comes up, and so it has again. CBC has an article trying to make a case, or at least relaying a case for lowering the voting age down to 16. Just to kind of quickly run through a couple of arguments that they're trying to make. First, they make kind of a constitutional argument that everyone has the right to vote. This is according to Section 3. Though when you look at Section 1, there's the reasonable restrictions clause. I don't think that's the exact term, but one thing that we have with the Canadian Constitution is that none of our rights are absolute. They're always subject to the reasonable.
Subject only to such reasonable limits as reasonable. Can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society.
There you go. That's the one.
Which is pretty vague. That's open to wide interpretation of what's reasonable and so on.
Yeah. And the vigorousness by which that has to be proved seem, especially nowadays with, I think as we've seen over the last 2 years, the government really doesn't have to do a lot to prove its reasonableness in restricting these freedoms that we apparently have. But nonetheless, when it comes to the voting age, this is the case that they're making, that everyone has the right to vote, and there is just no reasonable interest to not lower it. The article also makes the case, kind of a fun case, that the younger generation have more to, they're going to be more impacted by climate change. And really, you can substitute climate change out for anything because they are going to be impacted because they have longer to live. So whatever choices are made now, they'll have to put up with the consequences longer.
Yeah, that has a long-term consequence. You look economics, you can make the exact same argument that any decision made now that has a long-term economic impact, they're going to be the generation that's affected more because they're going to live longer into it. So
and quite frankly, that's where I'm like, for my kids, that's where I'm more concerned. It's not the climate change issue. It's the debt. It's the financial burden, the taxation burden that's going to be put on the next two and three generations, especially when we've seen the ridiculous amount of spending that's gone on in the last 2 years, particular, but even before that, they're going to be crushed under a tidal wave of debt rather than a tsunami from the melting glaciers or something like that.
But then the question comes up, is a 16-year-old, or let's push it even further, a 14-year-old, whatever age, are they knowledgeable enough to vote on these issues?
Well, okay. I guess this article would have kind of a little bit of a counter response. We already trust 16-year-olds, and the article lists through a number of different areas. We already trust them when it comes to employment, so we can hire them. They drive vehicles across every province at 16. They consent to sex by 16. They can leave home by 16. They can apply for passports at 16. So why can't they vote at 16? Hasn't that shown that we trust them already, that they're already responsible enough?
I would lean in the direction that maybe those other things should be considered an age increase rather than lowering the voting age. There's certain things that a 16-year-old is just not mentally prepared to handle.
Yeah.
And I think the long-term ruling of our country might be one of them.
Yeah, I guess when it comes to, like, especially when the driving kind component, maybe the insurance companies would have, like, if you're a parent of a teenager, I think you understand the kind of the insurance rates difference.
Yeah.
And that's completely age, because they are a higher risk group of people, partly due to their decision making. And there's a little bit of a counter response to, in the article, talking about how particularly in emotionally heightened situations, that teenagers and young adults have a more tendency to make less reasoned decisions.
Yeah.
So the article does point that out. They also mentioned, well, they pay taxes, so that would be another reason that they would have the right to vote. Another kind of counter response, a little bit of counter response to kind of the lowering the age, from another person in the article says that in general, 18-year-olds as a group have completed high school and they're starting to make their own life decisions. They must decide whether to continue their schooling or join the workforce. And so this often coincides with the decision whether to remain at home with their parents or move out on their own. And so 18 would be kind of more of a threshold where you actually are going to feel the consequences now of your voting choices. at least more directly, whereas you can perhaps be buffered a little bit by your parents in many situations. You know, perhaps if you're losing too much in taxes, you know, or the mortgage is too high because of some financial or fiscal policy,
right?
You know, something like that. You would be kind of cushioned at least a little bit with your parents, but 18-year-old seems to be the kind of a threshold, at least this person. And yeah, there's some arbitrariness to it. All right, so let's put out a couple of fun scenarios here for this age of voting. Going back to one of the arguments for voting was that they pay taxes, and so as a result, if they pay taxes, they should have a right to vote for the people making the decisions on how much taxes they should pay. And no, there's I think a reasonableness to that. I think there's something to be said for their argument. Now here's a scenario though. If you had to choose between paying taxes and being allowed to vote, or say up to the age of 25, you were allowed to you wouldn't have to pay any taxes, but you couldn't vote either. Which one would you take? So up to the age of 25, if you wanted to vote, you had to pay taxes. But if you didn't care to vote, then you wouldn't have to pay taxes. What would you choose? The taxes or the lack of vote, I guess, is kind of the threshold here.
I think in general, you'd see a lot of people choosing to just not pay taxes and not vote. And thinking back to when I was that age, I probably would have picked the same.
I wasn't making a ton of money, you know, especially since the minimum wage wasn't what it is now.
I think back, I got married at 19, so I was trying to...
You are already ahead of the curve on those.
Trying to deal with first being married and stuff. The thought of not paying any taxes, not having to worry about any of that, I can see some appeal to that.
Yeah, especially if you're kind of in that, just starting to get a family started.
Yeah.
Like nowadays, 25 and most people aren't even thinking of getting married. But no, I think that's kind of an interesting angle. That's kind of an interesting incentive.
You can get life started.
Yeah.
Without the burden of taxation.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting angle on that one. Yeah. I don't know what I was thinking much more selfishly, whether myself individually not thinking of getting married around that age, though I was married before I was 25. I think at that age I wouldn't have valued the vote as much. Mm-hmm. and even now I'm in most especially in the federal system, I'm basically a conscientious objector or conscientious abstainer when it comes to voting. And by the previous story is one indication of why. But yeah, especially if there was no parties I was interested in. I'll keep my money and you guys can run us into the ground. My vote's not going to make much difference. But no, I don't know. That's a kind of an interesting idea. Now this article is asking about lowering the age. I think there's a valid argument to be had about why not raise the age. And one reason for that is the older you get, perhaps speaking idealistically, perhaps as you get older, you become more aware of the world around you, the kind of the consequences of decisions and policies, especially at a large scale.
Yeah. A few years of paying taxes and trying to buy your first home and all these life events, spending a few years in the world experiencing those, you have a better understanding of the impact mm-hmm. your vote could have.
Yep. And so that gives you a little sense of the real world. But now let's take the age out of it and just say, what happens if you can just acquire that knowledge, you know, show that you're aware that these decisions are kind of being made and some of the consequences behind it. How about we have a skill based question before you enter into the voting?
Yeah. The voting ballot box, a set of questions that you have to answer to prove that you have some knowledge about what's going on. It doesn't, you don't have to be an expert.
No,
in fact, I don't think democracy demands that you're an expert.
No, no, no. Yeah. 90% of the population would be out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, I wonder what, like what I'm just kind of like thinking out loud about is, let's say there is five questions and like cycled through, or five questions that changed every election cycle or something like that. And it was let out, or like you were told ahead what the questions were and even what the answers were. You know what? Like even if you even spent the much time trying to memorize the questions,
you've then done enough
you've
work.
At least,
to,
yeah, I think you've probably done a lot more than most people probably do. Like I don't know what the questions would be. You know, name you know like two party leaders or something like that. Like something as simple as that, or name like the two branches of government, or like the two houses in Parliament. And, you know, if you can mention the House of Commons and the Senate, at least you have some understanding of kind of the progress.
Yeah.
Something like that. Something that shows that you've actually invested some knowledge into the process. I don't know. I'd be more inclined to lower the voting age if that was in place.
Yes.
Because my concern is not so much the age, it's the knowledge and the well-informed voting populace that I'm going for.
Yeah, I think if you had some kind of a knowledge-based system like that, you'd probably find that you get a bunch of 16-year-olds that know what they're doing. They've got an understanding of it. And you'd probably eliminate a whole whack of adults that have no idea.
Yeah.
Because we've got it in our heads that it's our civic duty to vote. That's what we've pushed for years. It is your responsibility as in a democratic society to vote, but we don't ensure that you have any idea what you're voting for.
Yeah. You have a right, and it's obviously often presented as this kind of responsibility, civic duty to vote. But it's never kind of tied to a responsible, you have a civic duty to vote knowledgeably.
Yes.
I think there's a difference.
There's a step like, missing.
I can go into just point me in the direction where you want me to put my X and we can be done with this. If that's what you mean, okay, then all we're doing is marking a sheet of paper somewhere.
And how is that really democracy?
Yeah.
You're not democratically choosing a leader. You're almost doing it by chance.
Yeah. I think that's a lot of what it comes down to. Especially in some of these last elections. I don't think it's the age that I have an issue with. It's just, it'd be more, if a 16-year-old could prove that they are informed on kind of the issues and just the running of government, then yeah, I might be open to this. I trust a knowledgeable 16-year-old versus, you know, that 25-year-old who just kind of lazily walked in and marked his X wherever he wanted.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, it's a little bit different than requiring age. It's a knowledge base. I think hopefully we can move in that direction. Hopefully maybe this podcast is doing a little bit of that. Who knows? That might be too ambitious. All right. We're getting closer to home. Alberta now. So this week I read in the Edmonton Sun, one of their columnists, Lauren Gunter, actually put out a column. Let me find the article. Here it is. And it's titled, "Why I'm Ignoring Alberta's Christmas Gathering Restrictions." And throughout it, he makes the argument that he's fully vaccinated. The people he's going to spend time with is fully vaccinated. He looks at different provinces and sees that Alberta actually has one of the most restricted, or has one of the most, or high, or one of the more most restrictions. What's the word? The most restricted gatherings.
Yeah.
Health restrictions when it comes to gatherings, put it that way, where the unvaccinated would only be able to have Christmas, or would only be able to participate with Christmas with their own household. No outsiders, no other family. It was just whoever you lived with would be, that's who you spent Christmas with. Whereas if you're vaccinated, you're limited to 10. Now this is 12 and up. So you can have as many kids as you want, apparently.
Yeah.
But, anyone 12 and up, you're limited to 10, including yourself.
But two households.
Only two households. Yeah. So yeah, only you and a friend's household or you and your sibling. You couldn't invite everyone in to dinner.
But I like that he pointed out in the article, talks about how he himself in the last, what is it, week before writing the article, attended two NHL hockey games with 18,000 or so fans in the arena.
Yep.
So yes. Seems to be some conflict here.
Especially, he makes the case that it's especially the case because everyone has to be vaccinated to get into the game. Yeah. And so he knows that everyone's going to be vaccinated at his dinner party or Christmas dinner party. So what's the difference?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he's got a completely valid point. So kind of in, I think this columnist is kind of pointing at where I think a lot of people are kind of tending towards. I think even the premier is sensing this. The numbers have dropped significantly since the fourth wave in September. Things are kind of getting back on track. It's not saying that the hospitals are empty of COVID. There's still some 300 COVID patients in hospital, 70 in the ICU. So there's still numbers involved in the hospital, but it's certainly not at the peak. And as a result, Kenny, I think, knows that people aren't going to be following such harsh restrictions as are set up now. In fact, in a Calgary Herald article, it says Alberta COVID committee mulls, quote, modest relaxation of measures ahead of Christmas. And then they quote Kenny saying that we have to be mindful of the tolerance level of the public to continue to comply with some pretty strict measures that we have in place. And so even he's looking, I don't think he really wants to be sending out, you know, the AHS to check in on your Christmas dinners.
But on the other side of things, I think he's afraid to lift restrictions too much, given the debacle we had with the fourth wave. Having lifted restrictions.
Or at least his messaging around that.
Yes. So having the lifting of all restrictions and things going into the fourth wave and a few issues that went on, his government took a lot of heat for that. And so if he were to lift any restrictions and we hit any increase at all, I think there's certainly a fear of what that's going to do to the public perception of the government.
Yeah, he's really got no political capital, at least as far as, you know, the media is trying to portray. I think there's some reason to doubt that it's as bad as perhaps the media is trying to portray. But nonetheless, I think he feels the pressure from his enthusiastic optimism during the summer and how much that kind of got slapped back at him. But nonetheless, I think, there's a lot to consider when it comes to Christmas and gathering. For me, at least one aspect, just to kind of, again, give my own two cents on this, the only, especially now that the vaccines are out, the only consideration I have that I think that should be considered when it comes to restrictions is whether or not the healthcare system can handle it. Because right now vaccines are out. So if you as an individual want to protect yourself, you have the ability to do that. I'm no longer directly responsible for you in that way.
Yeah.
And so you have now the access to the ability to protect yourself. Now, the thing is, like, how many people are not vaccinated that would perhaps flood the healthcare system again if all restrictions were lifted?
Yeah.
That's really the only consideration I have when it comes to this. I tend towards meet with your family, like get together, have Christmas together, have as many people as you want over. Obviously I'm not a healthcare expert. What I am though thinking of is that there's more to life than seeing how long you can live. And I think we've touched on this already before. Like we are more than just kind of biological machines to see how long we can keep the gears turning.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many stories I've come across now about, you know, people who've done all the right things, separated from family, you know, kept their kids home, and kind of basically isolated for the last couple of years. And, you know, then some tragedy strikes. Like that's how life goes. Like this COVID is only a threat. Is only one threat of death that we have. And I just wonder how much we lose by acting so fear-based on that one threat.
Yeah.
And how much life, like true living that we sacrifice, not just the time that we're talking about, or not just trying to extend our time, but what we do in that time. I know there's going to be counter arguments against some of that, but there has to be a little bit of a counter voice, I think, to those kind of, if you will, biological emphasis that government is all about. There has to be a counterweight to that. Otherwise we do end up turning into that. How long do we get this human machine to last, kind of mentality,
regardless of the conditions it's lasting in?
Yeah. Yeah. Perhaps there's a link. There's a article down in the States, the Surgeon General, kind of their main doctor down there, released an article kind of detailing some of the significant health effects on mental, particularly mental health effects on young people.
Yeah.
And kind of the devastation might be too strong a word, but not far off. Like one stat that came out to mind was, or that I recall, is that from 2019 to now in the States, hospital visits by, I think it was young girls, so I'd make teenager girls, jumped 51% in the last year or last 2 years.
Right.
So hospital visits due to suicide attempts.
Yeah.
So that's just one stat. And part of that is the result of this kind of isolation and a sense of hopelessness as this drags on and on and on. So, you know, everyone has to make their own choices when it comes to this. I just encourage everyone take a kind of a holistic approach to this. Be wise, be smart about your own situation. You know, if you're having fevers and hacking up and you know, like
maybe don't go
on. Yeah. Like have some common sense there. But the one thing that's bugged me the whole time is that we have to treat everyone as these kind of biological weapons that could be launched against us if we get together.
Yeah.
Unless there's some reason to think that you were carrying the plague with you, why should I treat you like you have the plague? And the COVID is not the plague.
Yeah.
I think we have to take a more holistic approach to some of these. And when Christmas gatherings come together, like this is a significant time of the year. Last year restrictions were perhaps just as tight, if not more. So a lot of people sacrifice Christmas.
Yeah.
And you know, how many people was that the last chance you got to get together because someone passed away and it wasn't due to COVID?
Yeah.
Like this might be it.
Yeah.
Take the time you got and don't bet it on the time you hope you will get. Think about the time you have right now, and what you're going to be doing with that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so getting back home to Penhold here. We'll end again on a lighter note. Maybe pun not intended, but I'll take it. the Tour of Lights of Penhold there is now out. So the town requested people to kind of submit their addresses to the town, and they've now compiled the list of the people who want you to come by. These are the people who actually are basically inviting you to come and look at their yard and maybe walk around their house.
You put all that work into Christmas decorating. You really just want to encourage people to see it.
That's right. And yeah, you don't have to feel awkward about staring at someone's house in the middle of the night around these addresses. So these people have given you permission to do that. Check out the town of Penhold's Facebook page. They have a list of, I'm going to guess, I didn't count through these, probably about 20-ish addresses, something like that.
Yeah, about 20.
Throughout town. And then I think the town themselves have put out some sort of special decorations. I haven't actually gone around to find them yet. Apparently, they got decorations located in different corners of the town. And the idea is like you fill out some sort of bingo card and submit it for possible prizes.
Yeah, we've done that in the past where some of it is even just people's decorations at their home. There's a unique enough one they put onto their bingo card and you go around and try to find all the unique Christmas decorations around Penhold.
Yeah. And yeah, there's some people have put in a lot of effort into it.
Yeah.
The one, did he list his? I think everyone in Penhold knows the house I'm speaking of. What's the name of that? What's the road that's on? It's the one by the Centex or the Chevron now.
Oh, on Minto or
is it Minto?
Minto is the one that goes right past the Centex.
It's the one that goes north. Oh, Robinson. I think it's Robinson.
Okay.
Yeah. Robinson. It must be 154. There is a Robinson. There's a 154.
The one that Robinson goes all out, the flashing lights, stuff on the roof.
He's got a fancy new kind of tree shaped one.
It does patterns and stuff. It's pretty impressive.
I drove by it on the way to recording here. Yeah, it was going through all sorts of different shapes and patterns. Yeah, it wasn't just blinking lights. It was a little bit of a show on there. So yeah, he's upped his game for this one. So make sure you take advantage of that. Again, great way to kind of travel around Penhold, perhaps get to meet some of the neighbors, some of those Christmas crazies, the lovable Christmas crazies out there with the lights. I just put a few strings along the front. Thank you to my neighbor for lending us his super tall ladder twice a year to put him up and take him down. And that's good enough. I'm satisfied with my light arrangement, just along the top and bottom of the house and around the windows, and I'll call it a day. But some people, they commit, and that's a worthy endeavor. I think it's always it creates just a wonderful atmosphere. So thank you for those people who put in that and the time, effort, and money.
Yeah, always brightens up, and it's just fun. The kids love it. It's pretty exciting. It gets the Christmas spirit going.
Yeah, no, good for them. And thank you for doing it. And thank you for joining us. We have traveled the globe, finally coming back at home here. Thank you for joining us on our journey. My name is Brian Constein.
And I'm Michael Rowland.
And this has been Penhold Talk Radio.